Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 290.NA0302, certificate number 38163. Crackers.
Dog.
Tree.
Fast.
Slow.
Rain.
Snow.
White.
Black.
Bean.
Pod.
Negro.
Whitey.
Crackers. Now, when I said that was the title of the show, you were like, saltines? No, the first thing you said was Christmas crackers.
Well, I thought it can't just be crackers. What else is there?
Christmas crackers. And I was like, nope. And you said saltines?
So it's got to be like Ritz.
Nope.
We're doing a whole show about the invention of the naval cracker.
Nope. No, we're doing a show on the racial epithet or a racial cultural epithet, cracker.
And, like, I don't want to jump too quickly to the chase here, but just so I know how much trouble I'm in, like, how bad is it to say cracker? I mean, obviously, white people are the oppressor, but also, isn't cracker specifically, like, a classist slur?
Well, it is. It is a classist and racio-cultural slur in the sense that it is most often applied to Scots-Irish immigrants to the United States.
Oh, it's my people, so I'm okay.
Yeah.
I'm clear here. My 23andMe says I can say cracker.
Well, you were saying that you actually have been called cracker.
I have, but not like, you know, in the fun, like walking through Philadelphia or something. That'd be fun. But I grew up in South Korea, pretty much the only white guy in my friend group. And we all thought it was hilarious to call me honky or cracker the whole time. Like we were a 1980 Richard Pryor skit.
Uh-huh. Were your friends Korean or was
Yeah.
So cracker and honky were actually made it all the way to Americans in Korea.
I guess. I mean, via the movie Airplane or something.
Sure.
I mean, I don't know if, are honky and cracker ever used by other non-white races to refer to the man? I don't know.
Yeah.
Like Latinos say honky.
Yeah, but you know, honky is a much more recent slur for American whites. Honky didn't...
Like you've been called honky more recently.
No, you know, thinking about it in my entire life, I don't think I've ever been called a honky or a cracker.
Do you want me to do it now so you can see how it feels?
No, it's not gonna.
That won't work?
It won't sting coming from you, cracker. Definitely someone did tell me to go back to Englang.
Oh, I remember that
story. Yeah, but other than that, no.
But she didn't say honky?
No. I've never been, particularly not in that honky.
I don't know why she would stand like that.
I've never been the victim of a racial slur. Interesting to think about.
Weird that privileged white people don't get racial slurs.
Particularly ones who live in Northwestern, generally lily white communities.
What a discovery we've made about something socioeconomic.
You know, there's always been I think in the last half of the 20th century, there's been a real desire in American culture, at least, for there to be an epithet directed at whites that is the equivalent of the extremely hurtful terms that we, you know, that have or evolved to refer to other racial groups.
When I see this, I think I mostly see it coming from a conservative ideology that would prefer to believe that in a colorblind society, it's as bad to have White History Month as it is to have Black History Month, for so on, you know, that kind of specious argument.
Well, and there's a lot of really faked outrage about being called cracker or honky.
Often what happens is you see somebody be like, it's as bad to call me a honky as it is to say N blank, blank, blank. And the response will always be, no, it's not, because you could spell out one word and you weren't willing to spell out the second one.
No, it's not honky. The thing about honky is that it doesn't appear anywhere until 1946.
Interesting. Some guy somewhere thought up honky. Who is that unknown hero?
Well, the derivation of it, it's suspected that it came from white culture in the mountains, in the coal mining culture. There was an influx of European whites who didn't speak English. And
like kind of the anti-Bohemian, the anti-Czech prejudices
of
that time?
So in the Hungarian language, bohunk is a term that's used that, you know, from which we get hunky or hunk.
Which was kind of the mean thing to say about Czechs, right? And
yeah,
Slavs.
It was just, bohunk was just sort of like a, you know, just a dumb.
I said it once on Omnibus because I like old-timey racial slurs that are like 19th century ones that don't exist anymore. And somebody got mad at me, like, you can't say that about
you can't say bohunk?
Czech Americans.
About Czechs?
Well, I'm not anymore. I don't.
Well, don't do it. But then it, you know, it kind of became a way to distinguish a certain group of white miners from a different group of white miners. Like, you know, you have to.
But the honkies were the new bad ones?
The honkies were the ones that didn't speak English natively.
Is there some onomatopoeia there? Like they're making, you know, a honk is an animal noise, you know, like goose honks. So, you know, I can't understand their words.
Yeah, maybe. Hmm. That's one of those things that the Wikipedia entry that someone edits from this episode will say cannot confirm or deny.
I mean, there's always a ton of folk etymologies around these things.
Yeah. And then it migrated into, you know, the popular culture as a way of, you know, as a retort or a companion to the pantheon of slurs that have developed for Black Americans.
And still describing poor rural whites in particular, or by that time a honky is anybody with low enough melanin.
If you look at Black culture in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, you see a lot of the, you know, the cultural movers, prime movers of the language and thinking coming from Black America.
Yeah, even white people are talking jazz slang very early.
Using honky to, you know, very quickly to describe all sort of white culture and sometimes even approvingly, like, oh, those are the honkies that support civil rights. But just as a way of
that, I would love to be called honky.
Yeah,
you know,
as a supporter of civil rights.
If they say that,
you know, you see Red Fox or George Jefferson in 70s television, and obviously, you know, it's a slur that everybody winks.
It seems quaint, yeah. not inflammatory. Maybe that's the generation I grew up in, and I'm out of date now. It's obsolete to think honky is cute. I don't know.
Well, who knows? Like, just the fact that we're doing this show is going to make some people uncomfortable, just because talking about race in America and words around race, it's very hard to know where the lines are drawn and what's okay to say and what's not. There will be people who are offended by the terms. But
do you have a sense that it's possible to be offended by these terms from the woke point of view?
Yeah.
It's poverty shaming to call a white person a cracker because they're probably not a successful white person if you're saying that.
So we saw this in the last decade, maybe a little bit longer, around the term white trash.
That's what I'm thinking of.
Yeah. So white trash is actually a really old term. But in the last 10 or 15 years, it's become, you know, there was a lot of anger around it because the suggestion was that that it was already astonishing that there would be poor whites and that, you know, you'd have to call them trash.
There's the normal white people, but then this is what I saw and I was reading, I don't know, Flannery O'Connor not that long ago, and you realize that a lot of the origins of white trash, the implication is these are the white people who are as far from social respectability as Black people are.
Like, and they're trash.
Yeah, we need a word for white people who are as low as Black people, and we're using the literal word for garbage, which I guess is not a compliment to anyone.
What's interesting is that the term white trash, it appears in the early part of the 19th century, was originally a black American term that was used by slaves that worked in respectable occupations, that were worked in the house, or that worked in the town, that had the population that had,
but not freed,
good jobs.
These are enslaved people, or
they're enslaved people, used it to describe white workers and people in the community that had lower stature than they,
not the boss.
And so, well, not only not the boss, but like that were lower on the social totem pole than someone who had, you know, who had education and training and spoke well.
Things have been upended. This is the prosperous end of the black social spectrum and the lowest end of the white one.
Yeah. So white trash only made its way into white vernacular at a time kind of later on in the 19th century when it was, you know, in the Civil War. We now and they then talked about it as a kind of like the white Southern heritage fighting against, this Northern, whatchamacallit,
usurpers and oppressors and invaders.
But in fact, you know, the war in the South was, even within the Confederacy, talked about as kind of the argument for the war is coming from the gentry, and the war is being fought by poor whites. And those poor whites...
And there was even discussion about this at the time.
Oh, yeah.
There was recognition just like, hey, this is just like every other battle. We're fighting the rich people's war.
A lot of resentment from white Southerners, poor white Southerners, where they were saying, you know, why are we fighting this war? We're not going to benefit from it.
Interesting things happening in the North as well, where, you know, rich kids can get off of fighting. The poor kids are getting sent to war and probably... they're not super passionate abolitionists, let's say, in many cases.
Yeah.
So like, we're getting sent here by Abe Lincoln for his stupid crusade.
It's a class war, but so much so that during the kind of Sherman's March era, part of toward the end of the war, Grant made an actual appeal to white poor Southerners saying, this isn't your fight. You know, we're here to free you as much as we're here to free the enslaved.
Did it work? Was there?
Well,
maybe no uprisings, but
in the immediate aftermath of the war, there was a kind of speculation that all these newly enfranchised poor whites were going to create a separate class. It was going to potentially be as bad as for the gentry of the South as a new class of gentry or of emancipated blacks. So white trash goes way back. And I think part of what we saw, at least in my youth and in my 20s, was a co-optation of white trash as a form, as a term of pride, because you saw a lot of punk rockers and cool kids saying like, I grew up white trash, and that means that I'm a more authentic rock and roller or whatnot.
They're just remembering what, hanging out at the mall and they had a beater car.
Well, the post-war version of that was trailer trash.
Right.
So the trailer as an indicator of low income was a thing that happened, I guess, during the Depression. Car trailers were first invented and then used as housing. And so the migration of white trash to a kind of oaky idea of trailer trash, then that permeated what we would call the lower social income class of the United States.
It's explicitly classist.
Absolutely.
This guy doesn't have a house. Lol.
All of this is extremely classist.
I was reading some comic, some DC superhero comic from the early 90s, and one of the heroes makes a joke about how tornadoes always find trailer parks.
Yeah.
And I remembered this comic trope of like, boy, why do these tornadoes always wind up in trailer parks? And I realized it was kind of a joke you would never make today. And I had kind of forgotten that it existed, that like it was a punchline.
Yeah.
That the trailer parks were always getting blown up and people were dying because they were in tornado alleys.
You know, in Anchorage, we always had a big windstorm right around Valentine's Day in the spring. And it also seemed to touch down in trailer parks. And what you then realize is that when trailer parks are hit with a strong wind, they break apart and they fly away because they're flimsy.
That's the imagery. You know, yeah. you don't see it on the news when it hits a brick and mortar building.
Yeah, right. And that used to happen in Anchorage a lot, you know, because the windstorm caused real devastation.
But people were dying, and that was like a punchline.
Yeah. Well, poor people were dying. Ha, ha, ha.
Exactly. That's how the culture works.
A lot of those terms that
and you kind of felt like you were on the right side of it because it was poor white people that are dying. Like, right. You know, nobody would make jokes about a poor black community getting hit by a natural disaster.
At least not by the 1980s. Well, yeah, maybe like, in the 1930s.
Yeah,
or 60s even.
Or like, you know, Nazis during Katrina. But in general, yeah. You know, you wouldn't have that kind of racialized take. But it felt safe because,
yeah,
you know, white people.
Well, I think the reluctance to make that kind of comment about black communities happened as a result of the aftermath of all the riots in the 60s and 70s, and even the riots in the 90s, where black communities really suffered a tremendous damage internally from rioting and fires and whatnot.
Yeah.
And trying to parse why that was happening. And it's the do the right thing problem. Like the white audiences walked out of that movie going, why?
That was their neighborhoods.
Yeah,
put the garbage can down.
And then black people walk out of that movie going, yeah, well, that's it. You know,
like they're thinking about Radio Raheem and we're not.
Exactly. And so it was no longer a thing that educated white people were going to say like, yeah, they burned down their own communities. You know, it's much more complicated.
Yeah.
Terms like terms like redneck and hillbilly.
Redneck.
Are also weirdly fairly modern terms relative to cracker and relative to white trash.
Are they 20th century?
They all are first in the record in the early 1900s. 1900, let's say. You know, redneck kind of a thing you would see as a descriptor of a farmer, or, you know, somebody that was out in the sun all day.
And that is what it means, right? Light enough skin and doesn't have an indoor job.
Yeah. You know, working class or a farm rural person.
Yeah.
But in terms of it being used as a pejorative against poor whites, both of those things didn't really come into the parlance until 1900.
Doesn't redneck convey a certain social outlook in a way that the others don't? Like redneck has come to mean, and they have the extreme conservative views you might associate with those people.
Well,
you don't hear that with, you know, white trash doesn't necessarily mean.
Oh, it does.
I mean, but you don't.
White trash, I
don't use white trash or hillbilly to mean they're voting for Trump.
No, white trash conveys moral decrepitude.
Yeah.
Right. To say someone is white trash or trailer trash, the trash is where you put the accent, and it did take on the character of saying like these are people that are like actually engaged in prostitution or engaged in drug selling,
yeah, addiction,
things that are not connected to redneck at all.
I just mean redneck comes with a connotation of some kind of pride,
right.
You know, you're not proud to be white trash. They're white trash are victims. Rednecks are proud of their white rural outlook.
Well, so this is the cracker, redneck, hillbilly sort of constellation of terms. Each one has been reappropriated and used to describe different groups of white people internally,
yeah,
by those groups, and also used as slurs.
We're going to reclaim redneck. It's cool.
Like hillbilly was a term used by the people in the hills originally. It's a term derived from sort of a Scottish, it's a combination of Scottish ideas. The hill people were people that in Scotland that had sort of become these clans that lived.
They're Highlanders.
Yeah, up in the rocks. And then Billy was just a Scottish term for pal or just comrade.
Just a guy, like a Joe, like a Billy.
But it only became a term, hillbilly only became a term after they immigrated to the United States.
It's not people in the cities using it as a separate differentiator at first. They're using it among themselves.
Initially, right? It's like in the one of the things that got me thinking about all this was I was talking to famed indie rocker Ted Leo, who lives in the in a more rural part of Rhode Island, a state you wouldn't think was large enough to have a rural
to part. Have hills, let alone billies.
But in the kind of coastal areas of Rhode Island, there's a term for rural. You know, we call everybody in New England a Yankee, but Yankee has this kind of industrious, educated, mercantile class.
Right.
But there are all these people in the Northeast that are rural and have all the kind of prideful separation.
Am I going to learn a Rhode Island slur here?
Yes.
I'm excited.
That Ted Leo at one point described himself as a swamp Yankee. And I said, what the heck's a swamp Yankee? And then he backed off and said, I'm not actually a swamp Yankee. I just live in swamp Yankee country.
And you better not say it. You're not from Rhode Island.
That's exactly right. And you, when you go around America, there are all these, you know, the, like up on Long Island near the Hamptons, there's a there are communities of like old clammers.
Who predate the money.
Who way predate the money. And they have their own dialects. They kind of, they're this group that their dialect sounds more like the dialect that are spoken out in the in coastal North Carolina,
huh?
Because they're these isolated populations of people that were still speaking in a kind of British-y, like lower class British voice, and they're getting all pushed out now by rich people moving to the wrong side of the Hamptons because they can't afford
the nice part.
And then they're like, no, it's the Hamptons, the whole thing. The other side of the island, still the Hamptons,
gentrifying the lighthouses.
So, you know, swamp Yankee was a term that if a swamp Yankee called another swamp Yankee a swamp Yankee, it was all fine. Mm-hmm. But if somebody in the big cities,
somebody in Pawtucket says
that's
that,
right. Somebody up there fight. At Brown, you know, you don't get to call me a swamp Yankee. So redneck and hillbilly, yeah, they were adopted as terms of pride for those communities, and so was cracker. Cracker in Georgia and Florida, there's still a big differentiation down there. Like, you know, or like I'm a Florida cracker, I'm a Georgia cracker,
and it's part of state pride.
Yeah, or that side of state pride. Mm-hmm. Nobody in Atlanta is gonna. I think if you called somebody a cracker there, who knows what you'd get. but there's a lot of, I think, retconning of the term. And I heard it a lot during the era when it was both being used as a slur and also kind of trying to put energy around it that that would equalize it. Because that desire...
Which side is that coming from?
Well, that's the thing. The desire from the black community to actually have a term that does
the sting. Yeah.
And then the desire of a certain aspect of the white community to have
to be aggrieved,
and to find that grievance,
and also to be like
nurse it,
and also to be like, well, there shouldn't be something sacred about the N word, you know? Like,
exactly.
I could be called something just as bad.
Sure, you could call me a noodle,
and there's almost some level of like, then I get to use the N word, right? Have we figured this out?
And part of that was an etymology of the word cracker that connected it to the sound of the crack of a whip. And that
right.
if you were
somebody cracking the whip, or the overseer is the whip cracker.
That's right. And so it was connected to a kind of evil, and that was part of what gave it the sting.
And I think I may have heard that more from, I don't know which side I heard that from. On some level, it's like, y'all are using cracker like in a fun way, but guess what? Like, it's a slave owner thing. So think about that.
Right.
Yeah.
And there is some, down in Florida, there was some sense of the crack of the whip, except it was the whip of cattle drivers.
Oh, because it was ranchers or whatever using that.
Yeah. And you know, the pushback on that etymology was just that the people we refer to as crackers weren't slave owners. They didn't even have the job of cracking the whip.
Maybe that's what gives you license to make it the word for white people,
right?
You know, because it's both high and low. But you're saying that's not a Okay, so it's not, it does not mean a whip cracker. Like, I was, I'm fascinated by this idea of when, you know, misunderstood etymologies determine which words get banned. Because a lot of people feel like it's an absolute, like truth should be an absolute defense. Do you remember the professor that got in trouble for using the word for cheap, the word niggardly, meaning cheap?
Sure.
And, you know, he insisted that there was no etymological connection.
That was something that was blanching little kids or, you know, or teenagers even back in the 80s. If you used that word, you know, everybody would gasp.
Well, for obvious reasons, like you're, until you get to that last letter, it's touch and go.
Yeah.
And somebody this week on Twitter used the word niggle to mean like a quibble.
Yeah.
Right.
Or a, like an irritant, like a,
yeah, exactly. You know. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
got yelled at.
Yeah. And it's true that, you know, if we care about the factual etymologies, yeah, but that's not what conveys social meaning, you know, like the license of a dictionary is not really what matters. Like, I'm uncomfortable hearing a word that sounds too much like a racial slur. And maybe that's more important than.
I mean, part of it is that we hate pedants.
Right.
And so the guy that's like, actually, you know, right. It's just shut like, up. Screw you. but there is the problem with that makes me uncomfortable, as we know, is that there are no boundaries to that. And you can be made uncomfortable by whatever you want.
And it's purely individual. Yeah. You know, no one's speaking for a, you know, it's not a press release from the Anti-Defamation League.
Exactly. The NAACP has no stance on the use of the words.
I saw a tweet. I hosted a TV show called Jeopardy Masters.
No, tell us more.
Well, I heard a highly rated primetime event, but I saw on Twitter somebody was disappointed that we would use a word that's shaded with historical weight, like masters.
Oh, sure.
And you're probably aware in the real estate world of the trend away from saying master bedroom.
Sure.
Because in a plantation, that was literally where the slave owner slept.
Well, you know, my daughter's mother is in internet security, and there's all this energy around saying that hackers are black hats.
Oh, interesting.
And people that are not hackers are white hats.
Well, there's a whole set of meanings around master and slave when it comes to different tech architectures.
Sure.
And I haven't been in that world for 30 years, but I assume that's all gone now. 20 years.
You know, I guess it depends on who your IT manager is, whether or not they are trying to, or rather, if your company has a DEI executive who's down there,
right.
You know, sending memos or not.
But just the straight-faced idea that the word master was now out of bounds, it had not even occurred to me.
Oh, the University of Washington
just
released a whole list of words. And
do they still give master's degrees?
Interdasting.
Because, you know, a lot of these uses, you know, they go back to master and apprentice, yeah. Artists producing masterpieces. This all, you know, predates American chattel slavery by centuries.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, if the goalpost, if it really is what makes vast swaths of Americans uncomfortable, like, I can see why the word master is a little bit tainted now.
But this is, somewhat of a question of how much Twitter reflects the world.
Exactly.
And it makes a certain tiny percentage of vocal people on Twitter uncomfortable. Yeah. And the vast majority of people have very little opinion about it.
And no university is renaming their master's programs. Exactly. And no museum is relabeling their masterpieces. And no golf tournament is changing its... Because what could be less racist than PGA tournaments?
I know, right? But, you know, this, and then, you know, unfortunately, a lot of liberals then decry the fact that every year there are more Black and Hispanic Republicans and wondering what that, you know, what that indicates.
John, you're a content creator.
Yeah.
You're a professional content creator.
Yeah. I'm a rhyme animal.
Are you afraid that you're about to get replaced by... artificial intelligence?
No.
Artificial intelligent content creators?
No. No, you could not with any amount of computing power duplicate what we do here on this show.
Because why would you try?
Why would you try? Even if you had all the computer time in the world. But B, how are you going to put in all of our weird pauses and strange vocal tics?
I mean, you think you couldn't teach a computer to do that?
Put in weird pause.
Well, as somebody who writes and blogs and makes things for a living, I would like to introduce you to the wonders of Squarespace. If, like John, you would like to create an online community around your content, let's say you want a fully integrated commenting system. You want to hear what the people think of your work.
Well, does it support threaded comments?
It does.
Does it support replies and likes?
It has all of the above. Huh. You can categorize, you can share, you can schedule all your posts.
Well, wait a minute. Is it optimized for mobile?
Your Squarespace site looks amazing on any device. Content will automatically adjust to laptop or mobile.
Well, what about cross-posting? I like to, if I'm going to make some content, I want to put it everywhere.
You want to make sure it's on Tumblr and Facebook, and if they ever let you back on Twitter, you want that too?
I do.
Squarespace lets you auto-post your content to all of the above, and all those posted entries and images are optimized and tagged, so your descriptions will be accurate and appropriate to the platform no matter where you post. You put it up once, and it's everywhere.
Ken, I'm going to head to / go to / check out squarespace.com/omnibus. But I don't want to just throw down a chunk of change right out of the gate.
Let me tell you what's going to happen. If you use that squarespace.com/omnibus URL, you'll get a free trial. And if you're ready to launch, just use offer code Omnibus and you'll save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
So thank you, Squarespace.
Thanks, Squarespace.
For supporting Omnibus and for being you. Cracker goes back to Shakespeare and before.
Really? For in the same meaning?
In the sense that...
Like a peasant.
Well, no. That crack... and spelt C-R-A-I-G in the Gaelic.
Oh, like a good time.
A cracking time, but specifically a kind of boasting, chatty, sort of, you know, someone who's playing the dozens, who's a great conversation, who's an electric, you know, kind of party personality.
And that's modern Irish culture. You know, you go down to the pub for the crack, and it's the good times and the conviviality and the music and all the rest.
Yeah, in Ireland, even now, you walk up to somebody and go, "What's the crack?" And it's referring to all of this kind of sport and yeah, good times.
So Shakespeare uses it to mean kind of a saucy person.
In King John, Act 2, Scene 1.
Oh, yeah, I'm picturing it.
You got it?
Yeah.
The Duke of Austria describes Philip.
You could be making this up, but I wouldn't know.
I know. Nobody's going to know.
Yeah, the Duke of Austria comes out. He says, "What ho, from what news from France?"
Yeah, no, there's 15 people listening who are like Shakespeare scholars who are like, ugh. He says, "What cracker is this same who deafs our ears with this abundance of superfluous breath?"
A cracker being, who is this chatty Cathy?
Yeah, somebody who's just
this joker.
Who's full of it.
Yeah.
Right. And it gets a, so this is 1595, and it gets attributed, or I mean, it becomes a kind of slur for Scots-Irish, specifically the kind of like prideful boasting that the Scots were famous for, in particular against their British masters.
Because Shakespeare doesn't have a lot of other races to make fun of, so it's always some Welsh guy who's just always talking about how much he loves being Welsh and leaks.
Exactly.
Because he, you know, if Shakespeare had other races, he really could have gone crazy.
Yeah, but well, you know, he had Iago.
That's true.
Yeah, that's one other option. But it became a slur for, you know, but one of a thousand slurs for the northern people in Northern Britain to describe this kind of, you know, the independence and scrappiness of these communities of Protestants, right? Ulster Protestants in Northern Ireland, Ireland and Scotland. Compared to the Church of England, these are Presbyterian Scots, right?
They're on the outskirts of society.
Yeah. And they're, you know, they're dirt farmers and they don't accept the hierarchy. And when the early immigrations to America happened, I mean, this is all described in a very well in a book by David Hackett Fisher. I don't know if you ever read it. It's called Albion's Seed.
I don't know it.
And it Albion's Seed describes the various and sequential emigrations to the United States, specifically from the British Isles, and says these people from the Southwest are the ones that came to Virginia.
Oh, they're regional.
Yeah, and these people from around London and from the Southeast are the ones who went to New England. And then the, you know, the Scots and the Irish went to the Appalachians.
So we just got a map of England.
Basically.
Mapped onto us, but on its side or something.
And what's very interesting is that the Irish that emigrated to the Northeast were from the South. So they were Catholic. So when you think of the Irish populations of Boston and New York,
right,
they're all Catholics, whereas the Irish and Scots that are in the Appalachians
hills.
Are all...
Appalachians, they would say.
Appalachians, that's right, sorry.
They get mad.
Are all Protestants. And Fisher in Albion's Seed makes an interesting argument that there's actually, because of the rough and tumble lives, you know, both like a subsistence at a subsistence level and also in a sort of constant war level of the people that lived on the borderlands of Scotland and England, that the Scots actually developed a larger testosterone production.
Like physiologically?
Yeah.
Wait, this Albion Seed guy is getting into
a little bit of
phrenology and race science here.
Maybe not race science quite. I mean, it's I don't know how you would.
I'm interested. I want to go around Appalachia measuring everybody's testosterone.
But so you know, they were very the border Scots had a very clannish and violent social culture, and they imported that even without the testosterone argument. They imported that clannish and ultimately like warlike culture directly to Appalachia.
They're feisty, whether you want to tie it to a particular hormone or not.
And you can read it in all of the colonial reports that the Tidewater and East Coast colonial authorities writing back to England are trying to describe why this very unruly group will not settle, will not agree, will not compromise, and they're a constant thorn in their side, even, you know, all the way back.
Are we just seeing colonial racism there? Like, you know how these lower classes are. You know how they're always drunk and, you know, it just seems like anti-Italian sentiment from the 20th century.
Well, except that Appalachia absolutely had a very separate culture, mm-hmm. and that Appalachian identity and culture extended out through successive emigrations throughout the South. If you think about Southern culture right now, a lot of it comes and it's kind of prideful, I don't know if you would say boastful, but certainly like that prideful and war fetishizing.
We do things our way. Yeah, we don't care. Right. If you don't,
and we're not going to take it, and we're very
South's
much
rise
gun
again.
Oriented.
Yeah,
you know, a lot of that came from that Appalachian culture, and then became Southern culture. When in fact, originally Southern culture was genteel and, you know, preppy and so forth.
And all that country music was just Scots-Irish. It was just folk ballads. That's from right. from the same fringes of England, right?
And when you think about now, I'm going to give you some statistics, and this is. These are statistics that often get misused by people in
Uh-oh.
This kind of argument, right? But, you know, the figure 12 million Africans brought to the Americas as part of the slave trade, mm-hmm. that figure is referenced all the time. 12 million Africans came across the Middle Passage. But 9 million of them went to Brazil.
Interesting.
And the actual number of African slaves that made it to what became the United States was less than 400,000, 388,000 Africans were transported, survived, and became
Americans. And are you going to tell me this is just dwarfed by the Southern cultural influence of the Scots-Irish?
Well, no, but that of the original, before the Revolutionary War, of the original 500,000 white Europeans, mm-hmm. specifically English, who came, somewhere between one half and two thirds of them came originally as indentured servants against their will. The crucial difference being that they were able to work and gain their freedom where the Africans weren't.
But by the numbers, America of that generation is being formed by
people who are here against their
will. Indentured people who don't want to be here.
So a lot of the whites who entered the United States were often, I mean, before Australia was developed, the United States
before
was
Australia
where
Australia was invented.
Before Australia was, you know, colonized, all of the prisons and the poor were sent to the United States. You know, London.
We say white trash because we are the trash dump.
That's
of,
right.
Of Europe.
The city of London took all the vagrant children and all of the unreformable and sent them here. And so, but what's interesting is that these cracker terms are generally used to describe southern rural whites and northern.
They escaped the
whites. You know, there was an assimilation process, although there was a lot of Italian and Catholic racism or Irish racism because of their different religion that lasted into the middle of the 20th century. And in my case, still to this day, our last episode, I had lots of disparaging
still hates the Catholics
to the Catholics and me.
When you found out I was doing the Camino in Spain, you were like, what?
Yeah, I was a little offended that you didn't ask me to go.
I'm walking across Europe, but I don't know anybody who likes to do that.
In 1717, there was actually a law, the Penal Transport Act, that in the UK that divested themselves of their prisoners to the US. And a lot of those prisoners, of course, well, most of them probably poor and low class. Mm-hmm. And this is in the United States. We have, because we both see ourselves as and are a meritocratic society in the sense that there's more social mobility here than most anywhere else. But part of the 20th century has been a process of seeing that more and more as an economic hierarchy. And we talk about the upper class being rich, the upper middle class being the more sort of educated and mobile but slightly less rich, middle class being entirely defined by its income, and then low class being both income and then we start to see some social approbation.
It's true. I rarely think about anything but income, whereas 100 years ago, it would have been much more about manners and genealogy. And
almost all.
Huh.
Because you could be...
You could be high class and poor. Your income could be very low, but you're still the right family.
My father's family was from the antebellum South, and they perceived themselves, even after they lost it all in the war and moved west, perceived themselves to be a very high station.
Gentility.
And it's part of why that and also that they were all Victorians, but you know, I have certain highfalutin mannerisms.
This is the definition of white privilege.
Yeah.
It's the origin.
But the you know, the idea of class has very little to do with income. It has
historically,
everything,
yeah.
Yeah. It has everything to do with your preoccupations and your cultural aspiration, right? I mean, the reason that you went to an Ivy League school was that you hoped to adopt the manners of the class that went to those schools without thinking. You know, the people that went to Yale not because they got in, but because their father went there. That was that thing we've been trying to dismantle in the last half of the 20th century. But that was almost entirely the appeal of it before, was that this was your opportunity as a middle-class person to learn the accent and learn the books that your social betters would have read.
I'm trying to think what the broader social thing is that happened that changed that. How did it become just income? Did everything become more buyable? Was it maybe now it's easier to falsify all the other trappings with money? Like that stands in for everything else? Or
well, it's just that it's in a meritocracy where people want to be able to have access to the top. The idea that you could never be part of the top unless you
right.
were members of an exclusive social group, and you can't buy your way in to the country club in group because that's all about families who know each other, historical connections to places.
It was actually our 20th century, middle class conviction that anybody can make it here.
Yes.
Means we have to depreciate those other things that are walls.
Yeah. The things you can't acquire. I mean, it's the Rodney Dangerfield in Caddyshack problem, as soon as you're the richest guy at the country club, but you still can't get into the smoking room, you're going to have to come at it a different way.
Yeah.
But especially now that we are trying to make a more diverse society, you're seeing these very quizzical situations where people are going to Ivy League schools, and the Ivy League schools are, as a part of their own self-reflection of their exclusivity and privilege, are abandoning the whole original, all of the cultural trappings that made those places appealing, which actually were class-based rather than having anything to do with education. Right.
I have a friend who, as a young person, spent a semester at a pretty exclusive school in New England, and sent their kids to the same school, and discovered there's kind of a raging controversy at this Vermont school right now. A lot of the vibe was this is where the children of privilege were sent to actually have an authentic rural experience, and you'd be out milking the cows and feeding the pigs and
learn to use a broom.
Yeah, you'd be, all, and
what, and these were character building.
Yeah, this is character building for upper class people. And now there's been an attempt to like broaden the appeal here. There's more scholarships. There's a more diverse student base. And suddenly you've got these working class kids of varying racial backgrounds who get there and are told, all right, it's your time to clean the bathrooms. And they're like, hell no. You think you're on the right side of history if you're making the black kid clean the bathrooms? Like, I shouldn't be in that rotation. And suddenly the school is examining, wait, these are this is the thing that made us elite.
It's the whole concept is you get to milk a cow.
And now that we've broadened it to make it available to everyone, it's what you're saying about meritocracy. It seems nonsensical, some of these things.
And this is the American story of the late 20th and early 21st century. Is that in seeking equality, it turns out that really what that is you just dismantle the upper class.
About time.
You just tear it apart. And, the upper class.
We replace them with tech billionaires, so we're fine.
Yeah, that's the problem, right? You replace them with people that are just rich.
Yeah, supervillains.
And don't necessarily have any taste. Don't necessarily have any interest in the public good.
You liked it when our supervillains had like better collections of stuff.
Yeah, right. Like tiny little things that they stole from Africa. No, but part of that, part of the upper class feeling of obligation was that they were the ones that invested in libraries, right?
Yeah.
That somebody like that Bezos doesn't, and I know Bezos is your pal, so I don't want to denigrate him.
Don't piss me off, Jeff. Don't make me choose between you and Jeff.
But he's, he seems less interested in libraries and more interested in his own ego space program.
Yeah, like they're all libertarians now.
Maybe the ego space program is the library of the 21st century.
First library on Mars isn't going to be a Carnegie library, John. It's going to be a Musk library.
But part of these terms, cracker, redneck, hillbilly. They were adopted by white people because there was a need to differentiate between good whites and bad.
So you're saying they're adopted by the upper class.
They eventually became part of the culture not because black people used them to talk about white people that were lower on the totem pole than they were.
Or even, you know, your boss at the factory who sucks.
It became popular because people out here in Seattle needed a way to denigrate working class people who were not aspiring to be members of the middle class, but who were confident and prideful about being hillbillies.
Because they're a threat to the whole endeavor.
They are. Because America is based on the idea that ultimately everybody wants to go up a level in class. And that's not up a level in wealth, because we're very happy to have
poor
white people, but we want them to aspire. We want them to be in the system. And when I say we, I don't mean, I'm not speaking for myself. I'm speaking
you and your friends,
the machine,
you and your indie rock friends,
the ziggurat. But it works, it keeps the system stable for there to be working class who know their place and understand that that place is where it is, and they buy in. And the thing about the crackers is that they have always rejected the whole enterprise. And
they're the original punk rockers.
They really are. They're up there in the hills and they're like, we're not even part of America. You can go right to hell.
And that's what scares the rich. Because there's people who, or, you know, that's what scares the well-heeled. There's people who don't even care about the stuff I have. Well, but I want everyone to validate the stuff I have, rich or poor.
Right. I don't even have that much money, but I do have a house in Kennebunkport that I inherited from my great-great-grandfather. How dare you say that that's dumb? And that, I think, is why those terms and that culture were, as they spread out from Appalachia.
Teach the controversy.
And started to become part of the cultures of Texas, Oklahoma, and then the low country of Alabama, Georgia, Florida, Carolinas. Why that pride was so appealing, and why that northern plan to make the poor whites of the Reconstruction South into a kind of like check against the rich taking back over, it became a kind of way that the South isn't going to rise again as a community of farms under regional princes. The South is going to rise again as some kind of rebel mountain community that doesn't.
Yeah, Braveheart.
Yeah, exactly.
It's going to be guys with blue faces, except they're going to have the stars and bars too, running out of the hills. And that concludes Crackers, entry 290.NA0302, certificate number 38163, in the Omnibus. Futurelings, you can find the Omnibus Project at social media, because we were a product of the early 21st century. Really, the only cultural time when anybody would try to tell you a hashtag at the end of their piece of art. We're living in it now. You can find all of our NFTs and our thoughts at Omnibus Project. I'm at Ken Jennings. John is at John Roderick, wherever he is now.
Wait, do we have NFTs?
We should, right?
Yeah.
Let's hop on that right now, right while they're hot. What would the Omnibus NFTs be?
What are they?
Subcomandante Marcos. He's looking at me right here. We'll have Marxist heroes like Subcomandante Marcos.
I just got a $50 gift card from Amazon. How do you feel about them apples?
You just got, like, it just appeared right now?
Yeah.
What did you do to, it's a meritocracy, John. What did you do to deserve that?
Patreon sent me a questionnaire, and they said, do you want to fill out this questionnaire? And I was like, no. And they said, we'll give you a $50 gift card.
And suddenly you wanted to do the questionnaire.
Like, oh, yeah. I'll do that questionnaire.
You just sold your precious data for $50, John.
It was so boring. It was just like
a mess of pottage.
When I do my Patreon, I feel like, A, people really want me to do video content. B, they kind of want me to do video content.
Does this mean they sent one of these to the Omnibus Patreon, too? I should go look at that and get my $50.
You should. It's $50, Ken.
But I always screw them up by just like giving them wrong information.
Oh, boo. You like to game the system so that they're not reliable?
I don't like to brag, but I'm a bit of an anarchist.
I get you.
I'll take my 50 bucks and they won't know a thing about me, John. I'm like the wind. I'll be gone. I'm Kaiser Soze.
I'm like the wind.
You could email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. You could mail us things. Physical items did not go through email in our day. We had not invented the thing in Tron that turns the orange into bits.
One day.
Or turns Jeff Bridges into bits.
One day.
I always thought he was going to merge with the orange, like in The Fly, like Jeff Goldblum does in The Fly.
What would half Jeff Bridges, half an orange look like?
It'd probably look like Jeff Bridges does today with that bronzer he wears. you can send those to P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155.
Do it. Send us things. What do you got there in the mailbag?
I have a few things here. Let me see. Ryan from Fort Wayne thanks us for continuing the Omnibus, even at its new weekly schedule. He says he buys postcards on the various endeavors that he and his wife embark upon. Mm-hmm. Considering each of you and what may interest you. Full disclosure, most of these may solely interest John. Please find 24 postcards from the National Museum of the U.S. Air Force.
Cool.
6 from Antietam.
Cool.
4 from the Henry Ford Museum.
Cool.
And 1 from the Cuyahoga Valley National Park. What would
Cuyahoga.
You say? What are you most interested here, John? Antietam, the Air Force, Henry Ford, or the Cuyahoga?
Well, I know you're not interested in the Air Force at all.
No, but look at these. Look what you get. Look at these postcards of planes for you.
I feel like sexy. The Cuyahoga you're going to like because of REM.
I like it because it's got the old-timey kind of WPA looking. Nice. For my birthday, somebody gave me a tabletop game called Parks, where all the cards are beautiful national parks art.
That sounds like a really fun game.
I don't even know if the game is any good, but I'm going to love looking at the... I like this postcard of an Apple computer super circuit board.
See, there you go. That's made for you.
This is from the... Oh, Henry Ford Complex has a Museum of American Innovation.
Sure.
Henry Ford loved American inventions, not by Jews. He loved it when people who were not Jews invented things and got ahead.
You know, the subset of American inventions that aren't connected to Jews...
It's pretty small.
Yeah.
Pretty small. So thank you, Ryan, for those postcards. We will fight over them. This is some kind of a map. What's going on here?
Don't ruin it. Oh, it's in a safety bag. You don't have to rip it.
This is from Crystal, because I wrote a book called Maphead. Crystal says to check out some sacred places. Okay. I don't know what that means, but I will do that.
Well, unfurl the map and let's see what it is.
This appears to be...
Oh, it's like a scarf.
Yeah, it's like a tablecloth. What is this? It's a world map. It looks like maybe the... Which of these maps is this? This is Ortelius, maybe?
Oh, it's like Here Be Dragons in the Northwest, isn't it?
It might be Waldseemuller. I can't tell which map this is, but it's
good old Waldseemuller.
15th or 16th century map. Some Dutch guy, probably. That's nice. And then what's in this little envelope? We may never know.
Cocaine.
Thumbtacks.
Oh, to put it up.
To point out locations. You know, thumbtacks on a map for...
You can put it up on the wall here if you want, or if you want to take it home.
I like it. Thank you so much, Crystal.
That's nice, Crystal.
And finally, Bill enjoyed the Magic Alex show about the Beatles and says that his son, we're talking about Apple Records era Beatles. His son Brendan picked up a bunch of these things at a yard sale in Pittsburgh. And so he sent us a little banner that says, look who's joined the Apple Club now. Oh. And it shows all four Beatles inside apples, eating apples. But it appears to be some kind of dental hygiene message. It says, end a meal with an apple. It's nature's toothbrush. It's
probably made by the Washington State Apple Committee.
Well, from the typeface, I'm going to say it's definitely British. But did the Beatles actually license their likenesses to a dental health campaign?
Those are pictures of them eating apples. So this must have been a coordinated effort.
Unless they just happened to find pictures of all four Beatles eating apples, and some enterprising dentist was like, you know what? I see an opportunity.
I find that unlikely that at any point they would be eating apples frequently enough that it would be a coincidence.
George and John appear to be in matching chairs, which would support your which would support your... Do you think as part of the founding of Apple Records, they just ate apples for that and then they got repurposed by dentistry?
The pictures of them are real Beatlemania pictures. That's pre-Apple Records.
I think you're right. Like, this looks like 64?
That's what I would say. 64, 65?
And Apple's not formed until 67. Right. Do you think they named their record label campaign? After this dental health campaign?
Maybe.
Thank you, Bill, for sending us your garage sale find.
No, that's wonderful.
Amazing. There will be photos of these on the Patreon. Speaking of Patreon, that's the way to support the show. I feel like when we first started our Patreon, we had a real burst of listener vigor.
Yeah, enthusiasm.
A real burst of enthusiasm. But we've had a bit of subscription fatigue.
Oh, I do.
Over the years.
People who use Patreon often... you know, support multiple things, and then they feel at a certain point like, oh, wait a minute.
Gotta spread the wealth.
Well,
this is the old one.
This is costing me $125 a month. Maybe I should prune it down. And then they think, well, Ken Jennings is a millionaire.
He doesn't
need that. And I go, God, you know, don't do that.
John's still living in his trailer.
Yeah, what are you talking about? I'm here hillbilly white trash.
Even though you have a family place in Kennebunkport.
It burned down years and years ago. No. We're not Yankees. My mom was Quaker.
John was never canoeing in any of the really good summer camps with any of the real scions of the rich and powerful.
Never once. Not accepted by them at all because I'm too rough and tumble.
Yeah, rough and or tumble.
Yeah, Northwest. I'm as Northwest as it comes.
They probably wouldn't have minded the tumbling, but you were so rough about it.
That's right. That's how we are.
So if you've been listening to Omnibus for a while and you've enjoyed it, it's time for you to fill in for some of those dopes who are no longer giving it their past level of generosity and energy.
Or if you're one of those dopes, come on back.
We still love you.
What are you doing?
I just called you a dope, but I didn't mean it.
You're out there supporting the dollop or something. Don't do that. Come back to Omnibus.
Take some webcomic you haven't laughed at in 5 years and transfer your dollars to... Patreon.com/Omnibus Project. We really want this more for you. You're missing out on a lot of cool bonus content that an elite class of non-crackers. What do you call the rich whites who are not crackers?
Who are nutcrackers?
Who are nutcrackers? The nutcracker suite.
Let's see. What do you call them? Do you call them rich whites?
Preps?
No. Yeah. Preps.
A-holes.
Right. You call them. Well, you call them sir.
You call them Ted Knight in Caddyshack. And not if for the Ted Knights, for the Rodney Dangerfields among you. No, wait.
Ooh.
We appreciate your support because Omnibus actually would not exist now without it for varying reasons.
Namely to do with you.
Well, the two reasons would be
me not.
Without the support, you couldn't do it because you'd be hawking your microphones at a pawn shop.
That's right.
And I wouldn't do it because I'd have better paying work.
Yeah, you have better paying work, and yet you still do it.
I'm here for fun.
And it's because of not just the fun.
For funsies, but also.
The comradeship and the, this is a thing that you own.
It's a sense of community.
Right. Whereas Jeopardy could fire you at any time, and may.
And you never know. They might listen to this episode and be like, you did a whole show about racial slurs for white people?
No. They're going to listen to this show and go, why isn't John Roderick hosting this program? That guy's got a lot of crack.
He's got a lot of chutzpah. He's rough and tumble.
Mm-hmm.
I did that. Facebook Futurelings is where you too can get that sense of community.
Reddit, Discord.
I'm here because I still think the show is pretty good. Honestly,
it's really good.
It's a good podcast.
It's a good podcast.
It's objectively a good podcast. And if we stopped doing it, there'd be one less good one and 10 more not so good ones would spring up.
Hopefully all the people that felt like, why don't they get to the topic, have moved on and they're listening to The Dollop now or they went back to Stuff You Should Know.
Why is The Dollop your bad guy? Those guys seem nice. That's a good show.
No, they just decided that they were the ones that I was going to be mad at today. It's always going to be somebody. Tomorrow it'll be, what are those movie ones? All the people talking about movies. I'm mad at them all.
Film sins.
Film sins.
Movie guys.
The movie guys.com.
I hate that show.
Yeah, those guys are jerks.
Am I a cracker if I crack open a Dr. Pepper right now?
I mean, you're a cracker because I can't see your eyebrows and I'm sitting like 4 feet from you.
So you're saying it is melanin. That's not your class.
But, well, now, you know, within Mormon culture, there are no class barriers because you're all equal. Isn't that right? Everybody gets the same amount of Jell-O every year. It comes in the mail.
It's a commune.
Yeah. So there's no slur for, I mean, there's slur for Mormons that don't practice Mormonism, and there's slurs for Mormons that are apostates that didn't get the memos.
I mean, depending on where the Mormons are, I'm sure they inhale whatever the cultural quirks of their milieu are. So,
but within the culture, you don't have like crap Mormons.
No, I mean, whatever it is just stuff we inhaled from whatever America's huffing at the time, you know. So there could be, you know, so that means in the early 20th century, it means racism. Right now, it might mean prosperity gospel crap.
But Mormons, but there's no manufacturing. There are no factories.
It's all sugar beets. Mm. Utah was built on sugar beets.
Mm.
So that's what the old... That's the old Utah farmers.
Sugar.
Yeah, I think there's even a Salt Lake High School that's the Beet Diggers. go Beet Diggers.
What they need to do is change that to BEAT and then talk about.
Because who among us does not dig a fat beet when it drops? It's universal. Like that one, for example.
Mm-hmm.
That's good.
Clap on the 2 and 4, Mormons. Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we wish you many goods and cheese. That belongs in there. And hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Ark.